Einstein, which is Einstein because if you were never Einstein, you wouldn't be here until the end.
What's that?
He's in a committee. He's in here. Senator Pappas, welcome to the committee. Are your witnesses
Madam Chair,
ready?
I don't know where my witnesses are, but that's all right. We can start. Madam Chair and members, I do have the A1 amendment.
Is that in her packet, Madam Chair?
Senator Pappas, do we have your amendment? No. Okay, it's being passed around right now. Thank you.
Madam Chair, while is it the A1? Madam Chair,
yes.
As the A1 amendment is being passed around, I would so move that for Senator Pappas to get the bill in the shape that she wants it in.
Thank you. Any questions for Senator Pappas? If not, all of those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, your amendment's adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. What the amendment does is it puts the bill in the same shape at which it passed the committee in the House, and it accommodates an issue that the Catholic hospitals requested. This bill will guarantee victims of sexual assault the same high quality of health care that we offer all Minnesotans by requiring all hospital emergency rooms to provide emergency contraception and sexually transmitted infection treatment to any victim that turns to them for help. Currently, only about 40% of emergency rooms provide emergency contraception or Plan B on a consistent basis. Emergency contraception works by preventing pregnancy before it occurs. It's not an abortion pill, and it will have no effect on an existing pregnancy. EC is a high dose of regular hormonal birth control pills. It is currently available over the counter to people over 18 years. In terms of sexually transmitted infections, victims often don't know they are infected for several weeks. And many victims will not seek follow-up treatment because they don't want to be touched, examined again. Undiagnosed and untreated sexually transmitted infections can lead to long-term damage such as sterility and cancer. So we think, Madam Chair and members, that it's really important that this treatment be offered to rape victims in the emergency room. And here to testify with me is Cassandra Moore, who is a registered nurse.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of survivors of sexual assault. My name is Cassandra Moore. I have been an RN since 1995. I have been a sexual assault forensic examiner since 1998. I am a nationally certified sexual assault nurse examiner in conjunction with being an ER nurse. In 2002, I became the program director for the Sexual Assault Forensic Examiner Program, the SAFE program. The SAFE program provides direct service to survivors of sexual assault in 7 community hospitals in our area. SANE or SAFE nurses have a unique privilege to work one-on-one with survivors. We provide an evidentiary exam to collect for evidence, a physical exam to check for injuries. We provide education on sexually transmitted infections and emergency contraceptives. We assist victims with reporting and that may be necessary and hopefully testify as an expert witness at trial. Our protocol is an exam can be completed up to 72 hours post-assault. If a survivor presents after 72 hours, they are then seen by an emergency room physician because it is unlikely that evidence would be able to be retrieved. Unfortunately, not all hospitals have access to the same programs such as this one. Currently, the best estimate of incidence and prevalence of rape is almost 15% of women have been victims of rape at some point of their life. Almost 3% of women are victims of an attempted rape. Sexual violence can be harmful with lasting consequences for victims, families, and communities. Women who have experienced sexual and physical abuse are significantly more likely to have a sexually transmitted disease. Over 32,000 pregnancies result from rape every year. Fear of pregnancy is one of the most common fears of women following a sexual assault. 34% of rape survivors in a National Victim Center survey feared becoming pregnant. In the past 10 years, I have seen great strides to support and provide services to survivors. In my experience, I have witnessed the look of relief when you inform a survivor that they're going to be taken care of. This is one small step that we can do to provide and relieve survivors of their concerns, allow them to heal from an incredibly traumatic event, and help them live their lives. Again, I thank you for your support, and the survivors, thank you for your time. I'm available for any questions.
And Mr. Chairman, she has some brochures here from her program.
We'll make sure they
anybody's
get distributed.
Interested. Then, Mr. Chairman, I have another witness, Ms. Dresden Jones.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Dresden Jones. I'm the Sexual Violence Prevention Coordinator for the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And I'm here to read a statement written by Beth Olson, who's the Associate Director for the Program to Aid Victims of Sexual Assault, which is located in Duluth. PAVSA is one of our member programs. MNCASA is a membership organization with over 60 sexual assault programs that we provide technical assistance, resources, and training for. So I am going to read Beth Olson's statement because she was not able to be here today. Hello, my name is Beth Olson. I'm the Associate Director for the Program to Aid Victims of Sexual Assault in Duluth, Minnesota. PAVSA is a sexual assault advocacy program serving southern St. Louis County. We serve all victims of sexual violence, women, men, and children, by offering 24-hour crisis intervention, medical advocacy, legal advocacy, professional counseling, and support groups. I have worked as a sexual assault advocate both in paid and unpaid positions for 14 years, the last 6 years at PAVSA. However, I am not here today representing the organization I work for. I'm here representing the many victims of sexual assault I have known for over the last 14 years and those whom I have never met. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. Sexual assault victims are crime victims, victims of felony attacks. The loss experienced by this crime cannot be measured monetarily, and their lives cannot be restored by the offender's terms of probation or offender registration. Victims of sexual assault have experienced a crime of humiliation and degradation that truly attacks their dignity and humanity. Sexual assault is the only crime where we ask a victim to go through an evidence collection procedure, a medical exam that mimics the very crime they've experienced. Not only do we ask them to go through a procedure that replicates the sexual assault, we ask them to do this as soon as possible after the assault, meaning that the victim is still in an acute state of crisis and trauma. The intense fear at this moment can only be imagined by those who have not experienced rape. A victim fears for her safety and for her future. This is truly a life-threatening experience, and one that does not end with the assault. The sexual perpetrator can leave many things behind for their victim after the rape. They can leave injury, they can leave behind a sexually transmitted disease. Some, if left untreated, can cause cancer, or they can leave behind the HIV virus. Additionally, the victim is at risk for pregnancy. This cannot be described as an unwanted pregnancy, as the victim was forced and coerced. The victim was raped. This pregnancy is a forced pregnancy. Emergency contraception can be provided as a choice that allows victims to avoid a forced pregnancy. When crime is committed, the state has an obligation to protect the safety of the community, hold offenders accountable, and work to restore the losses of the victims. It is the care of the victims that illustrates our humanity. By providing rape victims a choice and access to emergency contraception and preventative care for sexually transmitted diseases, we start down the road of restoring dignity, choice, and self-worth. If we do not provide EC in the ER hospital ER, we are essentially asking that sexual assault crime victims take care of themselves. There is no other crime where we ask people to provide for their own basic medical care. If someone were a victim of a shooting, we would not clean and stitch the wound and then send them elsewhere to pick up bandages. Those would be provided. The barriers to obtaining emergency contraception are huge. Emergency contraception is only effective for 72 hours, and the sooner it is taken, the more effective it is. Sending someone outside the ER with or without a prescription immediately creates numerous barriers to their ability to access EC. The cost is prohibitive for many, the limited access of pharmacies that are open 24 hours and carrying EC is real. As we all know, most of Minnesota is rural. The violation of privacy is profound, as women must go outside of the confidential world of the emergency room. This is a setup for victims. If hospitals are not required to provide emergency contraception and STI prophylaxis, then each individual rape victim will continue to be at the mercy of an individual institution's policy. And access to preventative care will continue to be dependent on where the victim lives rather than the crime the victim experienced. There was a time when one of two hospitals in Duluth did not provide emergency contraception for rape victims. 5 years ago, due to the courage of a young woman, an elementary school teacher who was raped and denied this care at the hospital, this policy has changed. Her experience provided the impetus needed for that hospital to review their procedures and policies regarding sexual assault victims. The provision of preventative treatment for STDs and emergency contraception was included. I commend this hospital for looking at the total picture of rape and rape victims and taking the stance of compassionate care. How many victims must suffer? How many stories must we hear to take the same stance as a state? This hospital only needed to truly listen to one. I hope the state can follow this lead. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the witnesses? I was curious in this You Are Safe brochure, how many people, how many rape victims get some help like this right away where they're told about collecting evidence and about what percentage of rape victims get help right away like this?
The seven hospitals that we service, we saw 167 victims last year. From January 1 to date, we've seen 33.
And out of how many?
That's very hard to say. Rape is one of the most infrequently reported crimes to get them in that time frame.
Questions from the committee? Sir Pappas, did you have any other witnesses?
No, Mr. Chairman.
There is one individual who wanted to speak with concerns about the bill, Mr. Pearson. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson. I'm with the Catholic Health Association. I have the story from St. Cloud Hospital just to give the background on how Catholic hospitals in some areas handle this. The Catholic Hospital in St. Cloud provides compassionate care to rape victims in central Minnesota that goes far beyond the requirements of this bill. In addition to the care of dedicated doctors, nurses, and other caregivers, they assist in meeting the needs of rape victims with mental health and social workers, as well as victims advocates from the community and law enforcement. The single goal is to provide the highest level of care to meet the needs of individuals who have been violated and who need their support. In 2006, they treated 88 cases of sexual assault. Sadly, they have a great deal of experience to build upon. The current protocols of St. Cloud Hospital were designed as part of a community effort convened by the St. Cloud Hospital to address the needs of sexual assault victims. The community sexual assault group meets quarterly and includes representatives from Central Minnesota Sexual Assault Center, sheriff's offices of Stearns, Benton, and Sherburn County, St. Cloud State University Women's Advocates, St. Cloud State University Health Services, Stearns County Police Department, St. Cloud Police Department, and the St. Cloud Hospital Emergency Room. The protocols artfully balance the interests of those in needs of the patients, caregivers, and community, and the corporate members who represent the interests of the Church of St. Cloud in seeing that we honor the ethical and religious directives for health care in Catholic hospitals. It is part of the standard medical protocols in our emergency trauma center to administer a pregnancy test to most women of childbearing age who present in the ER for treatment, because so many of our courses of treatment are counterindicated for women who are pregnant. In the case of rape victims, a negative pregnancy test enables us to administer both emergency contraception and prophylactic antibiotics to help the victims without being concerned about the health of a fetus. In the rare case where a pregnancy test is positive for a rape victim, we refer the victim to her healthcare provider or a physician because anyone who is pregnant needs to be in the care of a physician. According to the trauma center staff, approximately one female rape victim in the last 5 to 10 years did have a positive pregnancy test. In all cases, we provide a full range of services needed by victims to address their psychological and social needs and enable identification and prosecution of those who have assaulted them. For both medical and ethical reasons, we need to be able to determine whether rape victims are already pregnant and provide modified treatment based on their status. We're completely supportive of the goal of this legislation to help ensure compassionate care of those who have been raped. Our concern is for preserving the medical process and best practices in order to provide the highest level of service to our patients. We appreciate the efforts that have been made by many of the proponents of this bill to amend the language of the bill and allow us to both comply with this legislation as well as the values and protocols of our organization. I'd like to take this time to publicly thank the author for offering the amendment that does allow us to follow our ethical and religious directives. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this issue, and I will be pleased to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions for the witness? If not, discussion. Senator Brittner-Zolan.
Mr. Chair, I was going to move the bill.
Is there any discussion on that motion? Is there anybody else in the audience who wanted to speak to the bill? If not, and if there's no discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Pearson, so you don't feel there's a need for a conscience clause?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, I think the issue of the conscience clause already exists within the hospital under the statute, is my understanding, and that the amended language does comply with the Ethical and Religious Directive number 36, so that would allow us to do the pregnancy testing that we need to do in order to follow our ethical and religious directives.
Further discussion? If not on the...
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, I almost let it slip by. And Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, this is generally a friendly amendment in this committee, but I was wondering, you know, I generally... Delete title names of acts, and so I would ask that we delete lines 1-6 through 1-8.
Senator Fischbach moves to delete lines 6 through 8 on page 1. Senator Fischbach, in the committee I just came from, Senator Dill had a bill on land use planning and promoting livestock production. He wanted to title the President Theodore Roosevelt Memorial Bill to Preserve Agriculture Forests. That was a little, I think we might be wanting to name bills on very important subjects, but we've got a lot of names in the statute.
Well, Mr. Chair, you bring it through here, and I'll take that title off of it.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I know the Senate doesn't like purpose clauses, but I guess the Senate no longer likes short titles.
Not on every bill, but some bills, maybe. Senator, on the Fischbach motion, Senator Hand.
Maybe I should offer this a separate amendment, but I also have a small technical amendment that is on the language. Would it be appropriate to do it along with this one, or should we do it as a separate one?
Do it separately. We'll finish this one first. Any further discussion on Fischbach amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this just is with the author's amendment that we adopted, the A1 amendment, and on line 1.2, where it says on line 1.17 of the bill itself, to delete the word requirement and insert regiment. I believe they want to say regimen, but I would defer to counsel on that. I think regiment is a military formation, and regimen is a medical course.
Does anyone have a dictionary?
On the hand motion to delete the T.
That's from the revisor.
So. That's from the revisor, but that's the On the hand motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion? That Senator Solon moves Senate File 1266 as amended be recommended, passed, and referred to. Goes to the floor?
To the floor.
On that motion, any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Pappas. I want to announce, I think most of the people who were going to be coming here for my bill on mobile home parks, we're going to be dealing with that with the other mobile home park bill on Wednesday. So that is not on the agenda. I hope there's nobody here who's waiting for that. I think most of the advocates on both sides have been notified.
Yeah.
Is Senator Betzold here, or do we have Senator Hand? Maybe we'll deal with yours, and somebody can get Senator Betzold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I don't suspect that this will take too long a time, but we're here with Senate File 1790, which is a bill that was brought to me by the Department of Health, and you have with me Diane Ridrich, of the Division of Health Policy from the Department of Health. And Mr. Chairman and members, Senate File 1790 is essentially technical in nature. It involves the current practice of reporting adverse events in healthcare facilities, and it is modifying the current requirements slightly to include a patient disappearance of any kind, not limiting it to what happens after 4 hours. It also covers falls, in the current language is falls that result in death, but this is any fall that would be reported as an adverse event, and also any accidental artificial insemination using the wrong donor sperm or egg. And my understanding is that the original requirements were a result of the National Quality Forum guidelines, and those have changed slightly since 2003 when this bill was first passed. And so what we're doing here is, as I understand it, essentially putting us in conformance with the updated version of the National Quality Forum standards. And maybe Ms. Rydrich could maybe talk a little bit more knowledgeably than I can about the details of the bill.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Actually, I think Senator Hahn described it quite well. There are four technical changes in this bill, which would bring the department's adverse health events reporting system into compliance with recently adopted changes by the National Quality Forum. This is a list of events that was adopted and has been used for the past 3 years in Minnesota to report adverse health events that occur in hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers. Specifically, again, the first change is related to patient disappearances resulting in serious disability or death, making those reportable after any length of time rather than just triggering a report after 4 hours, making a change in blood type matching terminology, adding a 28th event related to artificial insemination with the wrong donor sperm or egg, and revising the event related to falls so that falls associated with serious disability are reportable in addition to falls associated with deaths. More and more states have been adopting reporting systems similar to this one, and many of them are based on this National Quality Forum list. So we do feel that it's important to stay in compliance with that list to improve our ability to compare and share data across states to improve what we can learn about prevention of adverse health events.
Thank you. Ms. Rydrich, could you give your name and title for the tape, please?
Yes. Sorry. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Diane Rydrich, and I'm with the Division of Health Policy at the Minnesota Department of Health.
Thank you. And now when you said that 20-some states have adopted, was Minnesota the first one to have this adverse reporting? Or?
We were not the first to have any sort of adverse reporting, but we were the first to have reporting based on this list of 27 adverse events and with a public report.
And out of curiosity, the disappearance for more than 4 hours, I presume some people are walking off for 15 minutes, but because of the nature of their condition, that would be a dangerous situation.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In general, the way the statute is currently written, a disappearance has to be for 4 hours or longer and then result in a serious injury to the patient. The change would make it reportable after any length of time, with the theory being that if there's a problem, it could happen at any point rather than just after 4 hours.
And do you have any idea how often somebody uses the wrong donor sperm or egg? I mean, is this a common problem?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we don't know. No other states have yet publicly reported data on that 28th event since it was just adopted. We would assume that it would be quite rare, especially in the facilities that do report into the adverse health events reporting system.
Okay, further questions? Senator Prettner-Solin.
Mr. Chair, and is it Riker?
Rydrich. Rydrich.
Rydrich? Ms. Rydrich, what constitutes disappearance? I mean, if it isn't for a period of time, and if somebody could be, I mean, in a corner someplace and not actually missing or...
Right. Senator Prettner-Solin, members of the committee. In general, when these events have occurred, they involve a person eloping from a facility or disappearing from a facility, and it's often from a psychiatric unit of a facility. I believe the way the statute is actually written is disappearance from the facility, so disappearance from the grounds of the facility rather than just being within.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Rydrich, it has to be actual elopement.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's correct.
But why don't we say that?
Senator Prentice-Sill and members of the committee, the specific language that we've adopted is identical to the National Quality Forum language. We generally give additional guidance to the reporting facilities on how to interpret the events. Sometimes this is referred to as elopement, sometimes as disappearance. But we generally work with facilities to help them understand how to interpret it in case it does happen in their facilities.
Senator Erickson Hopes, do you have?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Senator Han and Ms.
Redrick.
We're all stumbling on this. I'm sorry. I apologize.
If you saw how it was spelled, it would be even harder to pronounce.
My question is related to Senator Prentice-Solins, and there must be more description beyond just what we're looking at here, because I'm concerned also in terms of the direct care staff. You know, if someone is on the wrong floor and they just don't know where the patient is at the moment, I mean, does it identify the patient? And you mentioned, you suggested it might have to do with a psychiatric facility. Mm-hmm. But are they tied to diagnoses like that? Because a patient really could be wandering and not be, you know, in danger of hurting themselves or others and just on a different floor. What sort of confines or scope are we talking about?
Right, Senator Erickson Ropes, members of the committee. For an event to be reportable as a disappearance, the disappearance itself is not what makes it reportable. It's that something then happens to the patient as a result of that disappearance, which is the reason for changing the four-hour timeline. The theory is that if there is a problem in the system that allowed a patient to disappear from the facility and it resulted in injury or death, that could have happened if the patient was gone for a shorter time or a longer time. And the problem is with the system lapse that led to the disappearance occurring in the first place. So a disappearance without any impact to the patient would not be reportable. Does that help?
Mr. Chair, so you're saying it's a pretty tightly confined scope is what they're looking at.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Just out of curiosity, what's magic about October 7th, 2007?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's the date when our next reporting period begins. It was, I think, easier and cleaner to make it effective on the next cycle of reporting rather than mid-year.
Makes good sense. It's just an unusual date for a cycle of anything to begin. But okay. Questions on the bill? If not, Senator Dan?
Mr. Chairman and members, I would like to move that the bill be passed and would it be referred to the floor and referred to the floor?
Senator Han moves that Senate File 1790 be recommended pass and referred or sent to the floor. Any discussion? Anybody in the audience wanting to speak with concerns about the bill? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
We'll take up Senator Betzel's bill next then.
Yeah, we're ready for you.
Okay.
Sorry, I didn't know
there was the gavel. Okay, I was looking.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is file 1701, and I do have, this is the first stop of the bill, and I do have an author's amendment, which is prepared by the revisor of statutes, A070568, which I believe you have in your packet.
We do.
And I would ask that it be adopted to put the bill in the shape that I wish to proceed with the bill.
Senator Prentice-Solin.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, I'll offer your A070568 amendment.
Any questions from the committee? If not, all of those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is adopted.
And Madam Chair and members, if you also look in your packet, you find a document that's kind of covered with yellow and like that. This is the bill which now includes the amendment was just adopted. So you can read exactly as it would read. You don't have to try to look at the page and line numbers. This is how the bill as it is with the author's amendment included.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Betzel.
Yes, Senator Morgan.
Huh?
Thank you, Senator Batzold.
There you go.
We're so impressed.
Nice idea, huh? Now, let me further explain the reason why part of it is in yellow and the rest is not, is that a lot, the things which are not in yellow is current law. It's a lot of words in here, but a lot of it's just being recodified. So if it's in yellow, this is brand new. If it's not in yellow, it's current law. You could obviously still make changes and so forth, but just for your ease in reading through this, you can actually hone in on the issues that we're actually talking about. And if you want to get the others, you can. But this deals with electronic health records. As you can imagine, hospitals, providers, as the term is in this bill, are converting their records over to from paper records to electronic records. In fact, if you know, I've been an attorney working in the mental health area for a number of years. You go to a mental health ward, you'd ask to see the chart, they pull a three-ring binder off, you get these pages. Now they send you to a computer because that's where everything is kept. Unfortunately, a lot of the laws that we have on the books are geared towards paper records, are not geared towards electronic records. Last year, while all of us were kind of busy working on our campaigns and so forth, there were some there was a lot of work being done in this particular area. There was something called the Minnesota Privacy and Security Project that the Department of Health oversaw, and a lot of the stakeholders worked out the language. Now, I will tell you that, and as you can see from the fact sheet that you have before you, is that they did not reach a consensus on every single issue. There are still some issues that are outstanding. However, the two big issues that we have before you is the fact that if they're going to be creating medical records and it's going to be electronically created, at some point there's got to be some way to access them. How do you find the particular patient that is somewhere within the medical records? There's got to be some sort of an index. There's got to be some sort of a system where you can get in there. And when you realize the fact that, you know, we've got a lot of different hospitals and they've got all kinds of databases, it could very well be that if a patient shows up at Hospital A and says, you know, I had treatment at Hospital B in the past and I had some medications or whatever, there should be a way for the Hospital A that may want to communicate with Hospital B and find out what do you have and on this patient and communicate back and forth. So those are the two major issues that you have before you in this, and it's also obviously some of that where the controversy arises. The amendment that you adopted does allow a patient to say, I do not want to be part of the index. That is, you know, if you're maintaining an index that you can, you know, look at me and communicate with other databases, I don't want to be part of that. Now, obviously, if I will go on North Memorial Hospital, they can look up within their database to find out if I've ever been there before. That's fair game. But as far as them sharing with another hospital and saying, you know, if Abbott Northwestern Hospital says, what do you have on Betzel at North Memorial? If I say, I don't want to be part of the database so you can find me, then they have to take me out. The consent part is the other part of the bit of controversy here, and that is, obviously, if I am going to, if I sign a consent form, then to have one database share, you know, talk to each other, that's fine. But how do you communicate that? And you know, this is one of the strange things I thought of in here. This this bill would require a written consent form. Now, mind you, a written consent form is going to be on paper. So I signed something in writing for an electronic database. But somehow somebody's going to have to keep a file of my written consent. Presumably, if I sign a written consent form, it'll be faxed or communicated somehow to another hospital so they can share records back and forth. How far, and the particular language that has some concern, and let me find my other copy of that so I can point out, four lines, is it 30?
One line 30 in this one.
30 and 31. It says
it should be the same.
Yeah, a representative from a provider, representation from a provider that the provider holds a consent form for the patient. That is key language because basically the provider A is contacting provider B and says, okay, I have a signed consent form from my patient. Tell me what you have on background information. That's an overview of what the bill does. I'll turn it over to Mr. Golden from the Department of Health, and he can go up and be more specific, but I wanted to get the concepts before you so you've got the idea of what the bill does and where it's going. So,
Mr. Chairman, before that, if I could just ask a question to Senator Betzel, just so I can be clear, Senator Betzel, normally around here, anything that's underlined is new language. So everything that's yellow that we're looking at is new language, and everything that is not yellow that is actually underlined, that is language that is already in statute, correct?
Correct. Mr. Chair, Senator Corey, typically when you have something that's being recodified, that is current law, but you're changing a lot of things and putting it in a different spot and rewriting it, it has to show up as new language. And then there usually is a repealer because you're actually repealing old sections, even if, and there's a repealer that you can see on page 11, you're repealing the old sections even to put them in a new place.
Okay.
So and sometimes you do this just because you've got sections of law scattered all around and you want to put them in one place for ease because, as I indicated, this has been sort of an evolving area as we're changing from a lot of different laws dealing with the old paper records into new laws dealing with electronic records. And so it's just easier to put them in one spot. So, as I say, what is just white is current law. What's yellow is being new.
I appreciate that.
Senator Betzel, I'd like to tell you and the Health Department, I think that's an excellent way to sort out the difference by highlighting it, and I hope other authors and departments and others who are recodifying language everybody's life a lot easier that way because it...
Yeah, I commend them for their
I think it was a very wise idea, yes. So hope share that with other agencies.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden. I am the director of the Division of Health Policy at the Department of Health. I think Senator Betzel did a very good job at providing an overview of what this bill is. I think perhaps just to give you just a very brief background, part of what this is the department has the eHealth Advisory Committee looking at how do we exchange records, health records electronically to better facilitate care, to make sure that patients are getting the appropriate care, they're not getting redundant care, and that your provider has the full amount of information to treat you. As we looked at this issue, one of the things that we discovered is that with the language that exists in statute today, providers generally don't agree when and how a consent is required. So what this bill is doing is trying to add some definitions to help clarify so that all providers have the same interpretation of the statute. And then it's trying to add a couple of concepts that will help facilitate the electronic movement of a patient's health information between providers. The first concept is exactly the record locator service. This is an index that allows a provider to identify where a patient's records are at other providers. The protections that are put into this is providers may put identifying information about the patient as well as a pointer to their records in the index, but before any other provider can access that, they have to obtain the patient's consent. Only a provider has the ability to access that information. Providers have to provide the opportunity for a patient to opt out of that index if they would choose. The record locator service must maintain an audit log that identifies who has accessed that information and when, as well as it places liability on the record locator service for any inappropriate disclosures. Mr. Chair, committee members, the other major issue is the concept of representation. Briefly, to just give you a sense of that, it might be useful to just think about how it happens today. Today, when you're at a provider and that provider needs some health information about you, they're going to ask you to sign a written consent. That consent will be faxed to another provider. Once it's taken off the fax machine, they will evaluate if it meets their criteria for an appropriate consent. If it does, they will at that point hopefully fax back the information to you. You will not be at that provider still receiving care by the time the information shows up. What this concept is trying to do is to find a way to still allow the patient to consent to the release of any information, but to facilitate the real-time electronic exchange of that information. It does this by when you're at the physician, that physician still obtains your consent prior to being able to request any information. Once that information is requested, they can then communicate electronically that they have obtained that consent. For the disclosing provider, they must record who has made the request for the health information, what patient has had their information requested, what information was requested, and the date of that request. Then when that information can flow, it'll all happen electronically, and there will be a record throughout this entire healthcare system of the fact that the patient consented and what was used to release that information. With that, Mr. Chair, I would be more than happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Betzold, and Mr. Golden. Thank you very much. Can you tell me who the privacy advocates were that worked with you on this stakeholder process?
They are here.
Some would like to testify with concerns about the bill, so we'll have them in a minute. So.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Erickson-Ropes, yes, we had a number of people. We had Mr. Rich Neumeister, who is a privacy advocate. We had a professor from the university's bioethics center involved. We had legal aid involved in the process. There were a couple of phases to the project. We also had the Minnesota AIDS Project involved in the project. We had a number of the associations, which aren't the privacy advocates, but were also involved as well.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Betzold, Mr. Golden. It's kind of a mini reunion of the Judiciary Committee from last year, where we used to talk about these privacy issues frequently. And I guess on page 6, lines, 17, 18, 19, the different information that the locator service maintains, is that information, in other words, can patients access and find out who has been looking at their information? Are these things available to patients as well or only to providers?
Mr. Colgan.
Well, under current law, a patient does have the right to the patient's own records. I'm trying to find where that is right now. But there are patient rights. I think at least starting page 2. Yeah.
This is the audit log.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, you know, that's the audit log for the record locator service. Do they have the right to access that? You know, the bill is silent on that. It doesn't say that they have the right to access it or they don't. I guess the I don't have an answer to that question.
Okay. Although, Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, if you look, again, this is current law, page 2, starting line 30. Current law does a provider shall supply a patient the complete and current information possessed by the provider, any current diagnosis, treatment, and prognosis. So presumably you've got access to your own records right now. This does not change any of that.
Senator Betzold, I think Senator Hand's question, if I'm hearing it right, is can I as a patient find out who all looked at my record under this access?
That's, I'm not sure. Let's see.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, as I say, I think the answer to that question is the bill is silent. The language is silent on that. So from that standpoint, I think it would be somewhat dependent upon whether or not the provider would be willing to share that with you. I think that's a little bit similar to today's situation. You know, in statute, there are requirements that the provider must identify when they've released your record without a consent or without your authorization. But you wouldn't necessarily know, for example, within a facility every time someone has accessed that.
I will know, Mr. Chair, and this bill, if it passes from this committee, is going to have to go to the judiciary because of the liability and the privacy issues as well, too. So it's going to be a review at that stage as well. But those are obviously appropriate questions at any committee.
Further question for Mr. Golden. If not, we have a couple more witnesses who wish to speak with concerns about the bill. Mr. Neumeister and Ms. Brace.
Okay.
welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. For those people that are new to the legislature, I've been around in this body, in this room, at least 29 years, where I've testified about on medical records. I've even brought out some of my old files that 20 years ago I worked with Senator Jean Merriam and Senator Marty and a few other people where we could, rather than the hospital and providers tell us, oh, you can only have this part of the record or this part of the record, we got the law changed to where we now can say we want this part of the record or the whole record or whatever. And it's been that constant. Now, one of the things that we're doing today is a major policy change. You have to look in the details, and that's where it is. Devil is in the details. Now, it's so important to me that for appearing before committees over hundreds of times, I very seldom write out my testimony. But to me, in my advocacy of medical privacy and choice and autonomy for us here in Minnesota, it's important for me to be able to set straight what I feel and what my, as I express my testimony. It's important to point out that there are some differences when one talks about that all we're doing is updating current law. You can have current law and add a couple things in there. But when you go to electronic records, that concept dramatically changes. We'll use the example of U.S. mail and email. Just within our short lifetime, we have seen how something is sent to you in the mail, and you reading, and something sent to you by email, and it goes all over the places just by sending sent. The same concept is in regards to, I think, electronic records. The proposed changes in placing names of patients and the provider in the record locator service and doing a representation of consent is the governor's initiative and the health department's to making complete patient medical records electronically available to providers regardless of location. This initiative has implications as to whether an individual has choice over participation in the Minnesota Health Information Network, and two, the ability to control access to the contents of their health record, accessible over the health information network. The concept of consent based on representation, and if I may point that out to you, in the yellow, it's on pages 4, line 30 and 31. And then if you look back in the back, there's like representation, other kinds of things that says in there, but this is the meat of it. The concept of consent based on representation is based on the deterrence of liability and accountability and is looking backward rather than looking forward to strict access controls, authentication, encryption, among others things. With our sensitive electronic health records to be so easily accessed, this legislation should tip strongly in favor of prevention, not relying on punishing behavior after the fact as a deterrent. Based on representation, and again, because this term was very new to me, and all that, I went to the Black's Law Dictionary. And what the Black's Law Dictionary, and I don't have that in front of me right now, basically says that it's basically a contract. Left it my other place. It's basically a contract, what representation is. And so that's, if we're going to talk about it being a contract, we should have a little bit more things in there. Based on representation, how will providers authenticate the identity of the requester? The rapid dissemination of an electronic health record can be complicated. Will the requesting provider be able to store the health record or just have access to view the medical data? The electronic health record should not afford less protection for for privacy, consent, and autonomy than is presently afforded by the current fragmented, largely paper-based system. In this proposal, it brings less privacy for us as individuals. With the easing of the consent requirement through representation, which makes our health records more vulnerable to harmful social consequences, theft, fraud, breaches, data quality, misuse, and less control by us, there are questions that need to be answered. Some of those are the following. How specifically will the Health Information Network be secured in all its aspects when it talks from providers to providers? Two, what breach prevention is there to protect stored and in transit electronic health records and other medical data? How will providers be able to guarantee that electronic health records go to the appropriate person? Again, getting back to what authenticators, user codes, etc. How is the provider community going to guarantee that such information based on representation that is sensitive, such as mental illness, substance abuse, sexually transmitted disease, does not come over the electronic wire to be accessed and downloaded or viewed in real time when all you wanted was the back injury records? Will there be a continuous real-time auditing and access, a full accounting of disclosure? How will providers design and educate their patients to give them choice when they're going to be asked for this with electronic records and their consent to whether or not they want their health records available to all entities of a health information network or to the individual doctor? Patients shouldn't be able to say that they do not want their mental health or gynecological records available to their dentist or ophthalmologist. How will the electronic health record collected and received by a provider not be used for other purposes? Eight, and the last one. With electronic health records changing, the dissemination and uses of the health record changes. Who owns the data? Now, reference was made to me being on this advisory board, and I was a member of that advisory board, but I think even more on the e-advisory board that's doing some of these things. I think it's important to have a little bit more representation, using their word, of advocacy folks, security folks, to talk about some of these things. Now, the issue is representation and the issue of electronic. Now, the VA, they're doing electronic signatures. We have a law that deals with 325L. I can't see why we cannot do electronic signatures. One of the other things is that I would suggest is that it be important that if you're going to keep the proposal in, that the health department get together and do standard forms so that everyone in the state of Minnesota has to use standard forms for electronic health records. Now, one of the other things is the American Health Information Management Association talks about that if we're going to be doing some of the things that is being proposed, that let's put into law some of the things that I talked about, authenticators and various kinds of things like that. We have not done that. The other thing is that the polls show that there's a high interest in this issue. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, finally, I'll just say an established model of patient consent in an electronic health record setting would aid patients. This is not happening with the proposal. It is incumbent upon this committee to ask the challenging questions and to find substantive, reasonable, and informed answers before representation goes forward. I urge the committee to consider in an electronic record world all of its varied implications that I have somewhat touched upon in my comments, that patient choice is crucial to build into the policy and infrastructure. Providing patients with robust choice, autonomy, and privacy is an important part of the incentive individuals will need before entrusting their information to to a new system. So your choices are these, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. You can say a 1 year or 2 year, let's say, implementation date for representation, and these folks, with all others, can come back now and then show with you how this is going to work. Two, do a pilot project, which some entities have done, like Massachusetts and other states. You can say, no, let's get out of this. Let's go back to the drawing board and come back. And those are some of the aspects that you can do as policymakers. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Mr. Neumeister, with the I understand and share your concerns about a lot of this, but I'm wondering, right now, I'm visiting some medical facilities recently myself, and had lots of people having a lot of access to records, and it's amazing how quickly they can pull them up, and I'm sure I gave the consent, but I was just curious in terms of third-party payers and all the switching back and forth between this place and that place. I realize how harmful this is if the wrong stuff gets out, and I realize your points about how you don't need your dentist to see your mental health or gynecological records or whatever you were using as the example, but isn't it already out there and able to be abused? I mean, I understand the point about the representation, but in terms of generally just brief philosophical thing, isn't it already the horse is out of the barn and people can get the information that way, or?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't think the horse is out of the barn yet. It's getting to that, or else folks wouldn't be coming to the legislature to be able to get the change of the consent. We in this state have had a long history of where you make the choices, you make the decisions. That somewhat is being deflated a little bit with the electronic record. And again, there's a difference between paper and the electronic. Now, I don't know what the percentage is of in the state of Minnesota, how many folks are electronic, how many are not. But if you take at again, all the material that's been handed out, they talk about maybe a little two or three hospitals getting together, put their little electronic record thing, and then this over here. But then if you look at the design plans, whether it be nationally or statewide or whatever, they're all talking to each other. Basic concept has always been, as I've learned with CRIMNET, I've been a citizen member of the CRIMNET Advisory Board for the last 13 years. You get your basic concepts down, what you're going to do, what those kinds of things, before you start building and changing some of the things. And I don't think the general public and you as a legislative body have gotten your arms around those issues of electronic medical records and privacy.
Further questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Briggs, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Twyla Briggs. I'm president of Citizens Council on Healthcare, and we have some privacy concerns with this bill as well, and I appreciate Mr. Neumeister's comments about some of the different areas of concern about the bill. Let me just state as an overview that with this bill, if you want to look where this bill is driving, which is, I think, what you have to do, and part of what Mr. Neumeister referenced, is that they would not be coming to the legislature if we had this already. And so what's really happening here is that we're moving towards a statewide online electronic medical record. And we're also moving towards a regional RLS. And an RLS is the record locator service that is the controversial part of this bill. And as in addition to that, we're moving towards the health department being able to have the access that they were denied in 2002 when it became front page news and all the public learned that they wanted all this data from our medical records. But as soon as everything is made electronic, The law still exists. They pulled the rule. The law still exists. And so, therefore, it will be very easy for them to get the kind of access that they were looking for back then. I think when you're thinking about your constituents and you're wondering, you know, will my constituents want the convenience or will they be concerned about the privacy? Then look at what the Harris poll came out with just in September, which said that 62% of the public do not know that such a system, a nationwide system, is in the works. 42% said that the risk to privacy outweighed any of the benefits that they could see in the system. And 21% said that they needed to have a right to be outside the system. So now look at what this bill says. This bill says that all of our data can be taken by everyone who has it. So whether it's your pharmacy, whether it's your health plan, your doctor, your hospital, your clinic, anyone who has your data can put your data into this record locator service. The record locator service is not just for like three clinics together. It's really for regional sharing or statewide sharing. There could just be one for the entire state. The bill doesn't talk about the record locator service per se. It says that it's from participants of a health information exchange. The health information exchange is not delineated in the bill. We don't know who those people or those entities are or how many of them there are or how they will create the record locator service or who owns the data when it's in there or who's even responsible when it gets hacked. Now, if you're wondering about what's going to be in the record locator service, the RLS, which you have no consent over what data goes in there, it is any non, it's several things that the bill mentions. And let me just remember, see where that page is here. It's the identifying information on page one, line 19. And it says that those certain things will be in there as well as other non-clinical data. So it could be, for instance, it could be your visa number. It could be your record, your driver's license. It could be your social security number. It could be anything that they decide they will uniquely identify you as an individual. You have no right to not have this data added. The second thing that you have no right not to have added is all of the places that you have been, all the locations you have been, and not just from now forward, but the idea that we have that has been talked about in the House is to go from now backwards as well. So imagine that you have given your consent to someone to see what's in the RLS, but as Senator Hand said, you don't even know if you can ever see what's in there yourself, right? But you want your doctor, you want Dr. A to have the information from Dr. B, and so you say, go ahead. Meanwhile, Dr. B gets to see every hospital that you've been to, every clinic that you've been to, every pharmacy that you've been to, every health plan that you've ever been a part of, whether you've been part of the Department of Human Services and you've been on Medicaid, all of those things might be in there, and you have no choice. So what our organization really wants to do is to put the consent in that has always been a part of the history of this state, is that you cannot share this kind of data without consent. This data is going to go online into a central registry. It's going to tell a lot of things about you, as Senator Marty mentioned, the dentist seeing what the gynecologist, or that you've been to one, or you know which one you've been to, or that you've been to an oncologist or a dermatologist or a psychologist or anything that might possibly be in there. So what we're really looking for in this case is for that consent to be in there. And, of course, we would like for the audit log as well to be available to everyone so that they can see what kind of data they're going to let someone know. And the last thing that I will say is if you look at the if you look at what was provided in this amendment, you will see in 119 of the amendment, I'm sorry, 118, it says, at a minimum, any consent form that permits a provider to access a record locator service must include a checkbox option that allows the patient to completely opt out. This is very messy language. For one thing, if you have to understand that when you're going to give your provider, which could be an entire hospital, when you're going to give your provider access to the record locator service, it's a one-time access and it's forever, unless you write a letter or something to get yourself out, which means that you'll only get that opt-out option once, the first time that you're asked when you might be very, very sick. So it's really not a very good way to preserve your rights, this particular opt-out section. So I will leave you with those comments just to say that we really believe that we should continue with the patient consent requirements that have always been available here in this state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Senator Wergen and Senator Corey.
Thank you, Senator Marty. I don't have any questions for Ms. Brace, but she did raise some questions that I'd like to ask Senator Betzold if I could.
Let's first see if anybody has questions for
her. Oh, I'm sorry.
Senator Corey, did you have questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Betzold, I'm not very attentive tonight, so if you've said this, please forgive me and repeat it for me. Is there or can there be a way that I, as a patient, can see who's been looking at my records? Could that be made a part of this bill?
Mr. Chair and Senator Wergen, I don't quite know the answer to that because, as you know, hospitals, providers right now are, if they haven't converted over to all electronic records, they are. And within whatever hospital it is, the one up in Princeton or whatever, what controls exist to determine who and only who gets to go within the building that's there, who can look at those records? I don't know that, and I don't know, and that may be a hospital by hospital decision. Obviously, you know, does the eye clinic have a right to look at the records from the mental health ward? I don't know that. It's possible that because as long as you've got a system that's there, there could be people looking at things within the hospital that probably are outside the parameters of that. But I think those are the things that are well beyond legislation because those are things that are happening today and will continue to happen. The bigger question, of course, as Ms. Brace and Mr. Neumeister raised, is, okay, when you're now sharing from one hospital to another clinic, another provider, how do you, you know, we do have only a provider, and in fact, it's only got to be the person actually making the request. Where is it?
That only a provider can do it.
Only a provider can do that. On page 6, line 10, it says only a provider may access patient identifying information in record locator service. Now, provider would mean the hospital, so that hopefully it's just the doctor or the immediate people that need to see it. But if a provider means the whole hospital, then the hospital in Princeton is looking at the records that are in St. Paul, and how many people in Princeton are looking at those records in St. Paul. Hopefully all those people who have a need to know do that. But I don't know how you can perfect the safeguards to say that. I mean, we can write that in legislation, but you know, we're not running those computers at the other end either. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzold, I suspect that with records within a clinic, by all means, more than one person can access them and see them. So I understand within the system. I was asking more the question that and you don't have to go into a lengthy answer, but I think there should be some way that if my records are with Fairview Northland Medical Clinic, that if someone from Alina Clinic in XYZ town looks at my records, I'm not asking which person in that clinic. I just want to know that that clinic looked for some reason. So I would hope we continue to work on something simple like that. But then the second question that I have is this. One of the things that I don't like about medical records right now, to be very frank, is the fact that I can't see them very easily, and they're about me, for Pete's sake. I would hope we find a way that we can look at our individual records. I think it's pretty important to know what other people are writing about us. So I would want access to my own records, if that's possible.
Mr. Chair and Senator Wergen, that is current law, page 2, starting at line 30. A provider shall supply to a patient complete and current information possessed by that provider concerning any diagnosis, treatment, prognosis of the patient in terms of language the patient can reasonably expect to understand. Former Senator Merriam spent years trying to make sure that patients had a right to see their own records.
Mr. Chair, I know they can, but you have to beg and you have to sign and then you have to pay for copies and then you have to have someone standing there and then the list goes on and on and on. So it's not as easy as it sounds and it's about me, so I want to read it.
And starting on page 3, line 14, it describes the process, current law, you know, how the patient can get them and pay for them too at cost, but that these things, it is available today. So, yeah.
And Mr. Chair, the third and last question. Under your bill, if I do not want my records in a record retention system, can I be exempted from that? And just a simple yes or no.
Mr. Chair, Senator Worgen, you can refuse your consent. Your records are going to stay within your provider. I mean, if you've been treated at Fairview, they're going to have your records. But if you go to a different hospital, you don't have to consent to the sharing of those records.
Thank you.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Betzel, I'm a little confused about, and this ties to that question, to the last question. On page 5, line 6.4 to 6.6, if you could clarify for me, it says a provider or group purchaser. Well, you can read that. But I'm concerned about the part that says the records locator without the consent from the patient. Can you read that whole sentence?
Yeah.
Could you explain what that means? It seems to me that it is in contradiction with some of the language for the patient consents to release of records. What does this language mean?
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, no, what this is an index. So think of this as a card catalog, that the record locator service is essentially the card catalog. What this language allows is it allows the providers to put in the information into the card catalog that points to where your records are. So it identifies the patient uniquely, and then it says this patient has records at, for example, Fairview or Alliana or Aspen or wherever the patient has been seen. That information can be put into the record locator service so that it's available, for example, if the patient ends up in the emergency room or if you end up at another provider. What isn't allowed is no one is able to go to that index or card catalog and look that information up about you until you have provided your consent for that. And you have to provide your consent at each provider that would have access to that card catalog. And what the checkout box a little bit farther down does is that the opt-out option allows you to say, I don't even want to be in that index or card catalog any longer.
I understand, Mr. Chairman. I do understand that part, but I think the part that I have a problem with is the first one. I'm just not clear about, it says a provider or group, I may have to read it then. A provider or group purchaser may send patient identifying information and information about the location is fine, but patient identifying information without consent from the patient. So if I read it, the location is fine because that makes sense. It's the technical piece of it. But it seems to me that it has additional language that goes beyond giving permission for the location. So the technical part I understand, but it goes too far, I think, from reading this language, that it goes farther than that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, I might just refer you to lines 119 through line 121, which actually defines what the identifying information is. You know, one of the terms we had originally was demographic information, but we thought that identifying information was more accurate. This is the information in the index that would uniquely identify the patient. It would be their name, their address, their date of birth, their gender. It's the information that allows you to distinguish one John Smith from another John Smith, so that it's the two things. It's who is this patient uniquely identified. That's what the identifying information is. and then the location of the health record is the pointer. The record locator service does not actually contain any of a patient's health records.
Just what tells you where to look.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you. And just continuing on what Senator Torres-Ray was talking about, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Betzold, the part that you just referred us to, Mr. Golden, is, I'll just do one quick follow-up and then I have another question. Line 1.21 says, and other non-clinical data. I think we heard testimony to that fact, and it gets back to Senator Torres-Ray's question about there's a whole lot of other information that could come under the definition of other non-clinical data.
Mr. Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes, I think that's correct. I think one of the reasons that that is there is to make sure that, for example, providers do have the ability to take the information that they use to identify patients to actually have that. One of the obvious ones that's not there, but if it were ever passed, for example, a federal patient identification number, there's not one on the horizon, but if there were, that would be something that would uniquely identify a patient. I'm not entirely sure what other non-clinical data would be useful for identifying a patient. It would have to be something that the provider would normally collect and have to identify the patient. We couldn't think of any others, but we understood that there may be things such as a unique identifier, driver's license, maybe. I don't know exactly what else would be possible to go in there.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Golden, I think that's part of the point. You may have made my point. You don't know what other non-clinical data they could be talking about there, and I think I think pretty broad, but I'll leave that for a moment. And just, I did want to make a comment saying, you know, I think this is one area where I feel rather conflicted. As a nurse, I can certainly understand how this is going to greatly improve medical record keeping, getting information, access on patients very quickly. Somebody comes in the ER, punch, 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 information comes up. In terms of convenience and being able to deliver the best care possible to the patient as quickly as possible, I understand all of that. And yet it does come up against some privacy issue concerns that I have. I think I told this committee before, perhaps it was another one, but as a veteran, I was one of those millions of veterans who had private information, including my Social Security number and other personal data, stolen a couple years ago when we had that giant breach of security at the VA, through the Veterans Administration out in Washington, D.C. And that was just one employee who walked out or lost one laptop, and there was lots and lots and lots of very personal information that just went out the door. And that's one of my concerns about when you go to digital storage, is that right now any one of us could probably walk into any hospital in the area and make our way to behind the nursing station when they're busy and take a record and run out the door. So, I mean, stealing records is pretty easy, but you would not be able to run out the door with 4,000 charts. And, you know, 4,000 is still a pretty small number when you're talking about the amount of information you could get on a disk or track digitally. So, you know, I go back and forth. My daughter, Lauren, was born on Guam. We have to jump through hoops like you wouldn't believe to try to get birth records from Guam. It takes a long time, and it's this huge process. If we could just do this, the digital thing, it'd be fabulous. So I see both sides, but you know, and I'm not a lawyer, Senator Betzold, and I think perhaps the judicial committee will really be struggling with some of these legal issues. But just as a regular person on the street, I think people are going to have very mixed opinions about whether we go for convenience and speed of information, and there are going to be people thinking that's the best thing. And then there are going to be people worried about why should the government be tracking every, you know, medical thing about me. And I don't know about the rest of the folks here, but when I was running for Senate this last time, I said, on a couple of major issues, I said, the government has no right looking into my bedroom or my medical records. And so I'm just putting that out there for folks.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could offer a thought or two. First of all, my data was in that hard drive that was stolen, too. I mean, because I was I'm a veteran as well. It wasn't that long ago that the VA hospitals were keeping records on carbon paper, and virtually overnight they went to computers. We're not backing up. I mean, you know, the computers are here. They're here to stay. That's how the people are doing it. We're going to have to make our laws figure out what policies we really want in this area. No, you know, people love the Internet. They love to surf stuff, and yet they're appalled at the personal lack of privacy. I mean, things that are public records in courthouses and readily available are now available on the Internet, and people are spooked out by that, even though there's been public information all along. I don't like the idea that, you know, it's going to be somehow easier for somebody to maybe look up medical records on me, you know, but they could do it before. It's just easier and quicker now if they have the access to the computer. On the other hand, I would like the idea that, say, if I'm up in Duluth or Little Falls and I need medical attention, I like the idea that they've got a quick way to find out where my medical providers were and find out what my blood type is, what kind of medications I may have been on, and so forth, so that you know, I can get, you know, better medical attention than that. This is a balancing act, no question about it. And but as far as the computers, they're here to stay, and we just have to figure out what do we want them to do for us.
Senator Coring, then Senator Hand, then Senator...
Mr. Chairman, I would so move that Senate file 1701 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Judiciary Committee. Would that be correct, Mr. Chairman? Or?
That would be correct, but I have a feeling there are going to be some people who want to discuss
okay.
it further.
Okay.
First.
All right. Well, I would.
Senator Coring has moved the bill as amended be recommended to pass. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Betzold and Mr. Golden. Appreciate your work on this. And much of what Senator Torres Ray and Senator Erickson Ropes have expressed were concerns that I shared as well about the record locator service, although I do want some clarification on this information about the location of the patient's health records. Does that not mean that if I was a patient at a drug rehabilitation clinic or a mental health clinic that the record would point to, well, there are records for Senator Hand at this clinic, and even though it wouldn't give perhaps detailed information on the locator service, it would certainly give information that would be revealing about my health status to someone who looked. And so I think that again, as others have said, and Senator Betzold has said quite well, we all value the efficiencies of having these records be available in an electronic fashion, and it is a balancing act of how we preserve privacy and allow efficiency to occur as well. I'm not sure that what we have here really is comfortable for me in striking that balance. And I guess to that end, I would like to just offer an oral amendment on line 6.4 and insert the word not between may and sent, and simply require that there be active consent by patients when this information is provided in the record locator service. I think that there is a need to have consent along the way here so that patients and others who are giving up information or doing it willingly and knowingly what they're giving up.
Mr. Chair, the effect of this, of course, would be to change it to an opt-in. That is, there's going to be a record locator service one way or the other. Somebody's going to be compiling. But in order to be part of that, you'd have to agree to be part of that, and otherwise it would not be. I think it would... I would not support the amendment, but I just that's the option that we've got here.
And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzold, I think you're right. That would be my intent, is I think that has been described. Sometimes it's easy to give consent, and the consent once given is forever, and sort of you have to then recognize you gave consent and do some extraordinary things to take yourself out of the system or do things. But if you say, individuals have to agree up front to provide that consent before anything can be done. At least I think you have a better chance of getting a more informed decision made by patients.
Mr. Chair, it is not, just for clarification, once you're in the database, it is not, then this is just a locator. You're in there, and it just tells other providers where your records are, but it doesn't mean you're in there forever. Starting on page 620, line 22, this locator service must provide a mechanism for patients to opt out of including their identifying information, information about their location or health records. So, yes, you know, the way the bill currently is before you, you can be put into that if you don't want to be. But if you're in there and you don't want to be in there, you say, I want out of there, and then you are pulled out of there. So you have a way to opt out of the system. So you're not in there forever.
Senator Betzold, on that point, that language on 622 must provide a mechanism to opt out including their information about it. Mm-hmm. What I'm wondering, though, is what if it's already in there and you change your mind? That doesn't seem to say to me that you have to remove it. Is that?
I believe it does.
You would.
627
Mr. Chair,
and 8.
Yes, that's what we intend the opt-out to be. And just as a small point, you don't provide consent once for all providers to access the information. You have to provide consent for every provider that accesses it. So you would actually have multiple opportunities to opt out. But the intent is that, yes, the opt-out would remove the information from, it would opt you out of the record locator altogether.
Okay. Oh, yeah, and I do see on 629 and 30 that it does, they do have to remove it. Okay. On the Hand Amendment, is there any further discussion? That's the one that would you're saying would make it opt in.
Mr. Chairman, what was it? What was the oral amendment again?
Page 6, line 4, after the word may, inserts not.
May not send.
Without the patient's consent, yes.
Okay.
Is there further discussion on that motion? Senator Prettner-Solin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Golden, I think I would just want to clarify for myself. Somebody has to initially opt in. Is that correct? They do have to provide consent to be in the first place. And then after they're in, then they have to opt out in order to be removed. They don't have to continue to provide consent. Except to each provider that would have access.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prettner-Solin, no, that's not correct. What would be correct is that the providers or other group purchaser could put the information into the record locator first, but no one would be able to access it that way without your consent. And one of the reasons that we chose that way, we did consider that as an option of a consent in model. One of the reasons that we didn't do a consent in there's actually a couple of reasons. One is it would actually create a much greater burden on the patient themselves. And there are a number of people who have the ability to point to record locators. And a good example of that is the very reason that group purchaser is here, and it's probably one of the first uses of this. And that deals with medication history. So, for example, if you want to know where a patient's medication history is, instead of going to every provider who has prescribed, it would actually be much better to be able to get that information from either a health plan or a pharmacy benefit manager where they have actually accumulated the information that has what you've actually been filled as your prescriptions in one location. And that would be very difficult for patients to be able to consent proactively for those organizations because they would never see them, for example, where it's actually quite easy to opt out and to remove that information.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Golden, it looks to me also up above, but this may be related to something else, that a third-party payer has access to the record with even if you don't give consent?
Mr. Chair, Senator Prettner-Solin, no, that is not correct. And okay. If you look at line 6.10, only a provider may access the patient's identifying information and record in the record locator service. So the only people who have the ability to go to the index to find where your records are are the providers. Only a provider can find where your record is, but there might be others, such as a health plan or a pharmacy benefit manager, who would have useful information that you would want to share with your provider, and hence they're allowed to put a pointer into the record locator as well.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Golden, you'll have to explain that further. I don't understand how the third-party payer gets involved if they don't have access to the record.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prettner-Solin, they would have the ability, for example, if someone ends up in an emergency room and you want to know that patient's medication history, the best and most accurate place for that medication history would be at, for example, a health plan, where they have all of the medication history listed, as well as which ones have actually been filled of the prescriptions. So while they cannot access the record locator service to find anything from other providers, they are allowed to put information in that says, we would have information about this patient, so that the provider would know that that would be a source of information for information needed to treat the patient. It would still take the patient's consent prior to being able to get any of that information from either the health plan or the pharmacy benefit manager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Golden, so what you're saying is that they can identify that they are the insurer of the party if the party gives permission to access it.
That would be correct.
Okay. May I continue, Senator Han, before I decide whether I want to support you or not?
No. He wants your vote.
I work with medical records all the time, and I know that it's possible to create firewalls so that only certain levels so there are only certain levels of access. You know, some people have access to a portion of the record. Others may have access to a greater portion. Some may have access to the entire record. Some of the record is more protected than others. So I know it's possible to create firewalls so that only the correct level of access is entered. So I have less concern about that. I do have concern up here, though, in subdivision 6, and it's not. It seems like it's old language, where it says that that consent is not necessary. But it says it doesn't expire after 1 year if it's continuing treatment. And this would be in the record itself, not in the locator service. If somebody had a case of, if they were diabetic and the same provider were there, that provider would not have to renew that consent each year in order to access that electronic record.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prettner-Solin, are you talking, if you could just help me, are you online 5.24, 5.25?
Yes.
Yes, what that is current law. And what the way that generally works is when you go into a provider, they have you sign a number of consents. One of them would say, I authorize my provider to release records to another provider being advised or consulted with. I believe this exception was originally put into the statute in order to, if you refer a patient to another facility, this allows the records to follow that patient as part of a referral process or a continuity of care process. This was existing language. All we're doing is clarifying that it is as part of that continuity of care.
Well, I think that I think probably federal law preempts that then and requires annual releases of information, or at least common practice is to get annual releases of information.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prettner-Solin, I think it depends on what the topic is. Certainly, I know Senator Han raised the issue of substance abuse treatment. That clearly does have more stringent federal laws. There are some mental health laws that would be more stringent. But for routine medical care, it depends quite a bit on the particular provider or provider organization. And that's part of the reason for the bill. We had many of them in the room. There was very little agreement on exactly when this exception could be used and when it was not allowed.
Okay. So if I might clarify with Senator Hahn, then what you're asking is that no information may be released, or that no information may be put into the locator service without first obtaining the patient's permission. And actually, I have to say that I would not support that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fretner, so on again, the database would only contain unique identifying who you are and where they can look. That's your medical records. So, you know, presumably, if you're being seen at your hospital, they're maintaining their own database within the hospital, but the fact that, you know, they've got something on you is going to go into this database. So others, but if you show up at another hospital, if you don't give consent for them to go to the database, it doesn't happen. And, you know, so, you know, and if you want to out of the database, you're out of the database. So, but under the Hahn Amendment, that you're not even going to, your name and the location of your records doesn't even go in unless you initiate that.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm reading that Senator Betzel does not support the oral Hahn Amendment. And then I guess, is that right?
I do not, yes.
And then I guess if Mr. Golden, would you like to comment on the oral amendment or not really? What do you think as far as...
Mr. Chair, Senator Coring, we would not support that. We think that places a burden both on providers and to patients to make sure that this information is available within the record. We believe that the patient is protected by having to consent before anyone can access the information.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
One more question. I received a statement saying that the patient would never know that anything was there, but I think that it needs, and maybe that needs to be put in here, and maybe that's something judiciary can take care of.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be important for the provider to always notify the patient that they are in the locator service. They should be fully informed that they are automatically in the locator service. That is certainly something that we as providers have to tell the patients that they're in an electronic record and who could potentially access that record and what information goes into it. So I think that's a part of education that should be a requirement on the providers.
Senator Hahn, on your amendment.
And Senator Marty, Mr. Chairman, and thank you. But I think that the point is being made that I think the concern that I have is that people are automatically put into this record service, and they may not know that they are in the record service. And the information, granted, it's not detailed medical record information, but it would certainly be indicators or that may be revealing about a person's health status. And the earlier question that was asked that speaks to the information that's on 6.17, 8, 19, and 20 about who's accessing this record. And we had some discussion about should we not allow patients to have the right to know who's accessing. But if they don't know they're in the record system in the first place, then they certainly are not going to be concerned about who's accessing that information at some subsequent time. And so my concern is that as we do these things, that we just make sure that we have active consent going into it, so people who say, well, yes, I want to be in that service, knowing that it's not medical records, but it's this kind of information, knowing that other people are going to access that and going to learn whatever they're going to learn from those records, whatever that might be. So they do that with their full permission, rather than having them placed in and then may or may not knowing at some point in the future that they are in there and may want to get out. And I just think it makes more sense to me to have this be an opt-in, and we've had the discussion, so we'll let it go with that.
Further discussion on the Hahn Amendment.
Well, just quickly, I Mr. Chairman, I would just say that it's my understanding that let's do a hypothetical. Let's say I go to the doctor and he wants to check the system, and I have happened to have been down at Fairview Medical Center. They can see that there's some information there, but they have no idea what that information is. Is that correct? Absolutely no idea. But that information is there if they need to access that, if I give permission, correct?
And Mr. Chair, sir, correct. And plus, you have to agree to let them have the access.
Well, there you go.
That's another step.
Yeah. So, yeah.
On the hand motion, everybody understands what it is. Yep. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Chair is in doubt. All those in favor, raise your hands. Those opposed? This motion does not prevail. Further discussion. I have several questions. Senator Erickson Ropes.
I'll just say thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Betzel. I just don't feel like this is tuned up to the point where I'm able to say yes to it tonight. As I said, you know, and you made a very good point, Senator Betzold, about, you know, we are in the digital age. That's the way things are going, and I absolutely agree with that. But I don't feel like this piece of policy that we're looking at tonight is ready to go and has made it through the privacy filters that, you know, several people have expressed concern about. So I'm not all the way there yet, sir.
Mr. Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes, you've never had a bill before the Data Practices Subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee. and I think those who've been around us for a while, that's around here, they call that the subcommittee from hell. So.
Okay.
Yes. Senator Erickson Ropes, I had a bill with three co-authors out of the four members of the Data Practices Subcommittee once, and it lost 4-0.
Yeah.
After a three-hour debate. Senator Petzold or whomever, on Senator Hand's amendment, which I actually thought was a good idea, but I picture myself checking it. I know I would because I want to be part of this, but I also have great fears about people misusing it, not just the theft of the data and so on. But what about, there are no penalties in here that I see for bad faith stuff. Yeah. If your dentist decides they want to go on a, is somebody who happens to have access to it because they've treated you in some way or another, and they do want to go on a fishing expedition. What is there for somebody who's, I mean, I see how, what kind of thing hits somebody who is intentionally doing some, a stalker perhaps, who has access to your records under this, and because they've treated you in some way and they have, if they want to use it for inappropriate purposes.
Mr. Chair, there is a the liability parts are on pages 9 and 10. And, of course, there is a liability for record on 11.10 and so forth. if they maintain exchange negligently or violates provisions of section 114.293, I'm not sure if that covers it. But we do have, you know, there's liability issues in here, too, again, which is more properly before the Judiciary Committee. But, I, you know, there certainly would be an intent that if somebody, you know, uses this information, you know, perhaps Ms. Beyer-Kopensky, you know, can comment on that.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members.
Identify.
I'm Lori Barkopensky with the Department of Administration, the Information Policy Analysis Division. So we do data practices, and we're very familiar with the subcommittee. If you'd note on the subdivision 1 of the penalties section, violations of this section is also grounds for disciplinary action against the provider to the appropriate licensing board. So there are those vehicles as well.
Ms. Barkopensky, what about, though, I'm not talking here about somebody who negligently does it, but somebody who is really bad faith stuff, somebody who's a stalker or something else, and they're just doing, they're taking personal information about somebody and misusing it because they do have, they're going, I mean, I could picture a provider going on a fishing expedition through all their patients' records. I mean, I hope it's not going to ever happen, but people do bad things. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think there ought to be a criminal penalty in there for something like that as well. At least it ought to be. Mr. Neumeister, you look like you want to say something. You can pull a table up, a chair up to the table.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. The only state penalty on what has been possible, liability and disciplinary action was put in about 12, 15 years ago. There are no criminal penalties on the issues of medical records, either for disclosing or misuse.
the best of my knowledge. Specifically for medical records, no.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Barak-Kopeski.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Golden.
One question. If I understand you correctly, if this is a situation where a provider is accessing the record locator service to do a phishing expedition about the patient without accessing it, for example, for a treatment reason, this is a bad faith. You know, one thing that actually would provide criminal penalties would actually be that would be a violation of the HIPAA privacy regulations as well, because you would be violating, you'd be accessing patient information, because that would be protected health information under the HIPAA privacy regulations, and you would be accessing it without the patient's authorization for a non-treatment payment or operations purpose. So you would be, if that would have up to a criminal penalty in it.
And Mr. Chair, the current law, and you'll see this on 11.8 and 11.9 allows a patient to get compensatory damages and reasonable attorney fees if there's a negligent or intentional violation of 114.293 to 295, which is you'll find on pages 4 through, I guess, 7 or, yeah, 4 through 8. So right, there is some current law right now that would allow some damages for a patient for wrongful disclosure of current medical records.
Okay, and Ms. Barak-Kopeski, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, in addition, for any providers who are also government entities that are covered by Chapter 13, there would be misdemeanor penalties for violation and release of records as well and using them inappropriately, but only for that small subset of medical providers such as Department of Human Services, county-run hospitals, and et cetera.
I will ask that when it's, assuming this bill is headed to judiciary, that you at least take a look at just a general thing for misuse, not the inadvertent disclosure and so on, which I think the liability stuff covers, but for bad faith behavior, that there ought to be some sort of criminal penalty, and maybe HIPAA covers it, but I think we should take a look. Ms. Breeze, did you have a comment on that? I want to keep moving on this stuff, and others may have a few more questions, but I have a couple more too. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Twyla Bray, Citizens Council on Healthcare. Just to say that a lot of people talk about HIPAA, but the fact is that HIPAA doesn't really protect and doesn't have a lot of protections. There's been something on the order of 22,000 HIPAA complaints, and I believe only one of them has ever gone anywhere. And the problem, of course, with medical data is that it's very hard to prove what has been done once the data has been taken. So I think that we must always keep in mind that it's hard to prove. So I just wanted to let you know that. Thank you.
Which makes the criminal penalties less useful, but I think it's still worth. A couple other things real quickly. These record locator service, this is businesses that are in existence now, and I mean, are there people who are certainly in the business of providing medical records. Is this a new business? Is the state going to contract with somebody or with multiple providers?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I think perhaps based on that question, there's been a little bit of confusion. The state will not be running the record locator service. That would be point number one. Number two, this doesn't authorize record locator services. It simply talks about what are the example, what a record locator, what we would envision a record locator service to be the index in a collaboration of healthcare providers that want to share records, probably because they have an overlapping patient population. So, for example, there are people currently in Minnesota that are looking at how do we share medication histories in our emergency rooms if any of our patients show up at any of the other hospitals. They would be looking at medication histories be. You might have a record locator if you have a hospital that then has a clinic feeder system where the clinics generally refer to the same hospital to help them find where their primary care records are, for example.
So in other words, there may be, since most medical clinics and hospitals and everything relate to many overlapping patient bases, are we talking 20 record locator services in the state, or and they're already existing, but they'll now be taking on a new role?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that they're taking out a new role. This just clarifies
what their role is.
Put in and what are the consent requirements to access it. One of the things that we saw in our work group is there was quite a lot of disagreement about whether or not these things could be created and if there were any consent requirements. We had people that argued that, for example, under the current statutory definitions or lack of a definition for the term health record, that because this wasn't the medical record, the paper record, that this actually didn't have any consent requirements associated with it. The problem is that not all attorneys agree on that, and because they don't agree, there's a wide range. So what this is trying to do is be crystal clear about if you're going to use one of these indexes, these are the consent requirements that you have to follow at a minimum.
Couple more questions. And is there a way that, because again, it's there, we're giving them, once you have once somebody has access to my record, my records through knowing whatever identifying information is in there, can the dentist get mental health records? What's to stop? Is there a way that either by I limiting, I mean, the consent is I want to participate or I don't, I presume. Is there a way that, is there any protection to stop anybody from accessing any portion of your records, or is that all automatically assumed that they are limited automatically?
Mr. Chair, the answer to your question is when you consent to allowing someone to access the record locator, what that's going to simply say is you have a record with this provider. That you have not given any permission or consent or authority for that provider to access that record. You have simply told them where they would need to ask. In order to get that record, you must still consent in the same way that you do today. This bill does not change that in any way, shape, or form. It simply allows, through the representation, to allow after you consent for that to be passed electronically.
Mr. Chair, that would be me.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the thing I would like to add about that is the whole idea of representation of consent, because this for the first time is a time where a practitioner does not have to see actually your consent. They just have to have heard that someone has your consent, and then they can send the information over. And it's not even clear to us whether this language means that no one actually has to show you the consent, or if it is, in fact, that once you receive the representation of consent, that is to count as the consent. I think that the bill is somewhat unclear on that. But the fact is that the provider who's going to send your private information somewhere doesn't have to see your signature. They just have to have the representation that you have consented.
Although today, even today, Mr. Chair, if somebody goes to, if you get a release of authorization in front of you, there's usually a lot of things you can check off, and you can check off all records or this, or, you know, you can limit it or make it as broad as you want to today. Now, I don't know if fax machines are going to be around 5 years from now. We may have something different, but at least in today's technology, you still have the right to decide, you know, I'll allow you to see certain records from that facility and only those records, and I don't see that this bill would change any of that.
But the representation is not for the, it's for the, I would give my dentist authority to look at my medical records, and so I could limit it in each case there.
There's really a three-step process. First of all, again, if you want to be out of the index, you're out of the index. Assuming you're in the index, you have to give permission for them to even look in the index to see if you've got records that point to where you may have some information that might be helpful. Assuming that there is information somewhere that the doctor that's standing in front of you wants to access, you have to give permission to that remote facility to say, I will let you look at certain, I'll authorize them to release certain records and only those records to you. So you have to go through a couple of steps before that remote facility gets whatever record you authorize to the doctor standing in front of you.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Corey.
I'm wondering, it seems like as we go on and on more here, it seems like it appears that the committee's not comfortable with this, I'm wondering if I'm possibly considering a motion to table. Is that what do you think, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Coring, I'd rather we see for a few more minutes. If
okay.
I think there's a, my sense is like yours, there's a great deal of unease about it.
Right.
And but I'm not sure that I think there's some of it is going to be stuff that some members of the committee are comfortable with the Judiciary right. Committee dealing with, some may not be. But
and Mr. Chairman. Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I guess I know that the Judiciary Committee is very thorough, and I feel comfortable with this bill going on to them, too. So.
I have one more question, but does anybody else? Okay. With the, just so I know, I don't opt out of participation in this system, and I give my dentist permission to release to my dental records to, I suppose, the dental surgeon or something. Is there any way that the dental surgeon, once they have access to my locator number, they have no way to get any information out of there except what has been directed to them? Is that the case? Or could they, if they were doing bad faith stuff, could they dig in for other...
The record locator service only tells the dentist that you may have dental records, you know, say at some clinic in Roseville. Then, because you're on vacation, you got a broken tooth, and the dentist says, well, I'd like to see some, and so they go to the locator service. They find that you've got dental records in Roseville. You didn't remember where it was, but the record locator says what. So then the dentist that you were seeing right now says, okay, I'd like to see those records in Roseville, and you say, okay, fine, and you sign a release saying, I will release my dental records from the Roseville Clinic to you. There's nothing else that this dentist is going to see but the stuff that you have identified to. But so it's a couple of steps process. First, finding that you've got records somewhere, and then what records at that location are you going to release to the clinic that you're currently at. And if you say, this is all I want released, that's all they're going to get. And that's the way the law works right now, you know, because of all that you're going to get. It's just that today there isn't a locator service. Today you have to say, well, here's my clinic and so forth. And you'd have to provide that information.
Mr. Chairman, go ahead briefly on this thing. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. It's very important to get two things straight factually. One is when you do a representation of consent, it's for all your records, medical, not identifying information. It's basically the guts of about you. And when you do a representation of consent from one provider to the other, so if you're asking for a back pain, you're at provider A, provider B, that's where you're at, or where your back records are. The issue is, when it comes electronically, it's back to A. Will it just be back records in real time, or will it be other kinds of records? And that's where electronic records has some issues about some weaknesses. The second one is the RLS. If, let's say, a dentist wants your consent, and when they're a provider under the 140-something statutes, they get consent for an RLS, they may be dental, might be, say, HM dentist. Yes, there is a dental record. Either at the individual dentist, or sometimes if it's, let's say, it could be Fairview, whatever your records are in there, could be other kinds of medical records other than dental records. The issue is, what is being used as a name? If it says just Fairview, it could be in any of those clinics, but if it says ABC Johnson, and that's it, because there's a lot of individual providers too. Give you more information. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Page 10, line 16. You cannot exceed any limits imposed by the patient in the consent. So the patient says, this is all I want to release, that's all that gets released.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to just go back to, so I can understand this, on the construction of this index. First of all, who's actually going to construct the parameters? Who's responsible for that? And then secondly, on the provider side of it, if you've got provider A has parameters of who that person is, and they feed that into the index, How are you going to match that up with provider B? If they were off by an initial on their name or something like that, there's going to be a mismatch of records, a misidentification. How are you going to guarantee that that's all going to be the same person when you're transferring that information?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, I don't know that any of these record locator services exist today, but medical records clearly exist today. And just within any one hospital, any one provider, there's obviously ways that they can identify and call up medical records because you got thousands and thousands of patients passing through. And for them to go within their own records and find your records as opposed to mine, they have to find some way to do that. So it isn't too difficult to think the next step over is that, okay, if you've got to have some system right now to find medical records, how do you deal with one hospital and another hospital, and they're trying to, and one has to talk to another with the patient's consent and figuring out, okay, where are those medical records? So there's going to be a system somewhere. We're not going to design that here, but we're setting what the ground rules are going to be. Because with medical records, there has to be some way to find those records. And the only way that you're going to be able to sort out one patient from another is with identifying information as is prescribed on page 1, lines 19 through 21. Name, address, date of birth, gender, name or guardians, and other non-clinical data to uniquely identify a patient. So those medical records have to be able to sort, you know, the John Joe Senior from the John Joe Junior, and figure out who's who.
Mr. Chair and then Senator Betzold, but the index itself, they said that no one's really, the state's not going to be in control of that, and you could have, it sounds like, several intranets or networks, one with a Fairview system that sets up theirs and another with another set of hospitals. But those indexes are going to be, in that index, those identifiers are going to be the same even if they emerge in a different system. One last follow-up then. In the when we talked about this amendment before of not being able to opt in, it sounded to me like you'd rather not do that because it'd be easier to just put everybody's records into the system to begin with and then access them when needed. And yet you're going to have to build this system anyway. So why couldn't we just let people, once they need to access the information, opt into the system?
Into this index, they're going to have to go back and identify all of those places. In addition, there might be health records at, for example, a laboratory where they've had various tests that would be otherwise available. They maybe would have to go to those, but they just generally don't see those because it wasn't gone through the doctor. The case was with the health plan, for example, if they had medication histories, which is a very common type of thing that they would be able to quite well to the patient's health record. It's just very difficult to consent to all of those different places.
Ms. Braze, very quickly.
Thank you so much. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, just three things. One is that regarding your question, Senator Dahl, about the RLS, there's nothing that says there can't just be one RLS for the entire state. So it could be very big. It says that it's from a put together by a health information exchange. The bill says nothing about who that is. It doesn't say that it couldn't be the state of Minnesota. It doesn't say any of that. The question about the dentist, I don't remember exactly who asked that, but when he goes in to find out where your dental records are and he finds your dental records, and yes, you can only get your dental records, will he ask you, so what were you doing at Minnesota Oncology Hematology? Is there a cancer concern that we need to be concerned about during this visit? So that's the sort of thing that can be found on the record locator service. And the last thing has to do with consent in the online environment or the electronic environment, is the patient thinks that when they give their consent, that because they're not thinking online yet, they're thinking that somehow their record is going to end up over from one doctor to the next. But in an online, depending on how the consent is written, for that entire year, that practitioner could have access to your medical records from the second practitioner, because it's no longer paper to paper. It's not like you, and so if there is nothing that limits, then the possibility exists that rather than passing any paper anywhere, we simply get online and look what that practitioner has given and is the latest thing about you. So it's different. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Coring has moved the bill. I want to make one comment before it gets to judiciary, and that is that a lot of the issues of consent, one of the witnesses suggested, why can't we use electronic signatures instead of the other one? And I don't know, but I hope that will be looked at. But the one that I think, besides concern about penalties, but the other one is a form. Somebody suggests a standard form for consent. And given the fact that when I've signed these forms, it's kind of, yeah, do you want? Can we share these records with whomever we need to share them with? And I think the protection of the privacy goes largely by limiting what records are available to whom. And I do think that that's something worth exploring, whether we should have a standard form for consent that the health department or somebody might design. But
Mr. Chair, that's a valid point, because many providers, many organizations simply will not take a form unless it meets their own internal criteria. So you can have one hospital send, and then we'll send it to the second one. They say, well, we are not going to release anything because you didn't meet our standards and so forth. So perhaps that's a point that is going to need some vetting, where and it's probably going to require the department to come up with so that everybody can take one form and be done with it. But maybe, you know, it's an important issue. I don't know that it needs. I don't think that I think it can still pass this bill without having that done. But that's a good point. It's an excellent point.
I think it does do more to protect the privacy of the patients, if and the fear of it being spread. If I know that I can look at the form and make something useful out of it in terms of what information am I passing on to whom, because passing on any affiliate who's going to be working with anything related to me is sort of what I think I'm signing now, and I'm not sure I feel.
But, Mr. Chair, does anybody ever read them, though? That's the other
Senator Hann, and then perhaps we're ready to vote.
And Mr. Chairman, this is to the motion that Senator Coring has made, and I'm just wondering, is it a higher motion to move this bill to judiciary without recommendation?
It's a higher motion.
Then I would like to make that motion.
On the hand motion, is there any further discussion? Anybody else in the audience who had a pressing need to speak out on this? If not, on the hand motion that this bill be referred to the Committee on Judiciary without recommendation. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. You're on your way to judiciary. With that, no further business before the committee tonight. I think we're meeting Wednesday.
Wednesday.
When? Wednesday. Wednesday at ETS. After session. We'll let you know.
Okay.
With that, this meeting is adjourned.